When you come in on Monday and you're not feeling real well, does anyone ever say to you, sounds like someone has a case of the Mondays?
No. No, man. No, man. I believe you get your ass kicked saying something like that, man.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, what condition my condition was in.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Oh. Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, that's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown.
Well, welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tamao. Greg Pappas on the board and in studio. Matt Byrne is a little under the weather after his trip to New York. Did he say if they won or not?
No, he said he was sick.
Oh, they're up for some kind of radio prize. Ricky both went. Matt runs a small college station, and they get. I think they won last year, the year before, didn't they? Or something. They got a nice little deal going there.
Not bad.
Anyway, he's going to accuse some New Yorker of infecting him. I think. New Yorkers
maybe?
Do, you know, those dudes.
Directly from China?
Yeah, some guy right from Wuhan in the fashion industry.
Bingo.
Yeah, he was hanging around where the fashion guys are, maybe not. So what are you, S&P futures down 65, NASDAQ futures down 259.
Yeah, we got problems today.
Yeah, what?
Apple's down.
We were down last night. Yeah, we were down last night, then we came back, then we were down a little more, then we came back, and then all of a sudden we're down. What the?
Yeah. We got Oracle later. That should be interesting.
This afternoon?
Yeah, they are supposed to, I think, earn about 149. Not sure. Yeah, it's after the close. So.
Well, maybe, who knows? Maybe we'll be involved in that. We started the year out, full disclosure, doing really well in these earnings stuff that we do, and then all of a sudden February, boy, how many stocks went two and a half, three times straddle? I mean, it's crazy.
Lots of volatility.
Yeah.
I think this week we have a few. Nothing.
Micron's usually late, too. Is that this week, or has that already happened?
Micron?
Yeah.
I mean, look. I see Adobe.
That's always one. We play that one a lot.
Yeah, Adobe, Sentinel, Dollar General, Ulta.
Are you going to change the name to $1.50 General?
DocuSign. That's these are all.
We've done something in there.
Yeah.
So you get to know the names. You get to remember when you do the stuff in there all the time.
Lee Auto, $289 a
Bitcoin
share.
Down to 82,000 after the government says they're going to make it a thing. Kinda
interesting.
Weird. Yeah.
Yeah, I saw the ETF was down 5% overnight, and Bitcoin was unch. That was interesting.
Yeah, some of these ETFs aren't exactly...
The ETF was down, and Coinbase. I think Coinbase is down more than 5%.
Let me look. I think I have it on my screen here. I'm sure I do. Yes, I do. The symbol is coin. I've got them down. Wow, $12.
Yeah. So IBIT, the Bitcoin ETF, and coin are down significantly, you know, 5% or so. And then Bitcoin's just kind of sitting there, 82,000.
So the guy in Canada is saying he's gonna charge 15% for the states they give electricity to. Why are people so upset when guys essentially hit back? I mean, it wasn't their idea to hit, you know. But we can't. I don't think is that maybe more of a John Flanagan question when he calls in is,
you know, it's because Bitcoin trades all weekend. I didn't realize it's down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They actually have a Saturday and Sunday settlement. It was down like 5,000 yesterday, I think, wasn't it?
Wow.
Because I looked last night, it was down 5,000, and all of a sudden it's down 300, but it's the same price. So I think they actually have a Sunday settlement. Not like that. You know, not like what the stuff here, if you get here, the stuff in the regular market, traditional market, if you have a day where like it's a holiday where it's like, you know, President's Day or something where the futures might trade for a little bit, still Tuesday morning we'll take the movement from Friday night, right?
Yeah.
Or I think Bitcoin doesn't. It takes it from
the session before.
A Sunday session. So you got to be careful with that one a little bit. That's if you're doing something with the Bitcoin. But
I wonder if who's got the futures, CME or Cboe?
I think the CME, but I'm not. Cboe tried to it, and they it was so lousy the first time they just bagged it. I think.
So well. Coinbase off a bunch. Might be an opportunity to sell some premium in there.
That's one possibility. Sometimes when it's high, it's supposed to be high, right?
Yep. Yep.
Now we got the VIX at
more juice for us.
Almost 26, 25.73. That's kind of a lot. But you know, you have to really pay to play. I mean, the Qs, QQQs, which is the NASDAQ 100 ETF. Friday afternoon at like 1:30, and the stuff that was in expire in an hour and a half with the straddle was like $4.
Yep.
So yeah, I mean,
best time, in my opinion, forever to be a trader. It's so wild that you got infinite options to pick from what you want to trade, and then also
you have to have your back to the wall though at some point.
You could be trading oil, you could be trading stocks, you could be trading Bitcoin, it doesn't matter, it's all pretty volatile.
But you can't trade anything without a backstop.
Stomach.
Well, it depends on how you want to trade it. I mean, if for instance,
buy the dips, sell the rips. Well, same thing for everything.
Problem with the dips is you never know where the dip is gonna, it's either the dip or a falling knife. We have
stay small.
Well, that's one part. But I'm saying you actually could have your. We have actually been able to do that, Greg. You know how we do it. Our protected.
You can trade.
Well, I'm saying our protected program.
Treasuries have been wild.
But we have the protection on in advance.
That's called a static hedge.
Yeah. So when you can move your strikes up and down, you're actually buying the dip or selling the rip, but you're doing it in a controlled manner. You never lose your protection. So there's always a. The worst that can happen thing to you that isn't all that horrible. I mean, otherwise you're trading
naked Tesla options.
Well, I'll give you an example. I used to trade in the OEX for 20 years.
Nvidia was $700 or whatever. Tesla was $700. You trade those options.
Well, Nvidia now is, or Tesla is now what?
It's $255.
Is it even that high? It's down again this morning. Let me kick it up here. What I'm talking about, Greg, is the in the OEX, it's down $7, $255. It was $460 last November.
Yep.
If we all of a sudden look like we're heading south, you know, because we've had days like this before, times like this. First thing I would do is look up in the book. Now, people know what that is. There's something called a customer order book. We used to have where customers were actually preferenced. People think the customers are doing better now because commissions are cheaper. Think again. The rules used to favor the customer, now they don't. Anyway, I'd look up there and I'd find some put that was so far out of the money, nobody'd even, you know, nobody'd even think about it, and I'd buy a bunch of them. I'm not talking thousands. I'd buy a couple hundred at like a 16th. And people would say, why the hell are you doing that? And I said, well, because then if we go
free insurance.
Well, if I sell something against them, at least I know I now have a spread on and I'm not totally naked. Plus, if an hour later, if you keep going down, somebody else who needs the units is going to pay an eighth for those things.
Then you double your money. Yeah,
you can either sell them at an eighth naked, or you can sell them at an eighth because you bought them at a 16th. Which would you rather do?
I think I'd rather be long and then have them to sell.
Yeah, I think that's the whole idea, is to get ahead
cheap
of the game.
Cheap insurance.
It almost doesn't matter what strike it is. Well, within reason. I mean, the Qs are 486. If you buy like the
at that point, you're long Vega, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So
you want to get units ahead of other people, the people that demand units. And when I, you know, I can't emphasize enough.
It's called buying the dip.
Well, sort of, yeah. But it, buying a dip in advance. But the people who look at the VIX and see it as a regular stock or a regular number, I've been talking about this for 20 years. I've been on the air. It's not the same as a stock. Just be careful, because I was standing there in 1987, and when you're asking people to do when you buy puts, you're asking somebody to sell you insurance, correct?
Right, and it's cheap sometimes, and that's when it's a good time to buy it.
Right, but that's not when people buy it.
Right, people buy it at the wrong time, just right. Like when they buy everything else at the wrong time.
Right. So now, you could have bought Tesla insurance probably very cheaply when it was $460. Well, now I think you're probably paying through the nose.
Yep.
And now, but it was $450, now it's $255. When did you need your insurance more? Probably when it was $460, right?
Well, some people want to buy more down here, so
yeah.
They didn't want any insurance. They wanted it to go down. Other people who are watching every day probably not so happy about that.
Well, my point is it's not like stock where you drive the price up and you can actually just get more stock. If somebody is trading in a pit and you want to buy, whether it doesn't matter whether it's me, whether it's some other trader in the old days, or whether it's a big firm, all these people have risk parameters. So whenever you go in there and buy something, it could be Citadel, for God's sake. When you go in there and somebody buys 1,000 puts in the queues, they're happy to sell them to you at a certain volatility, because maybe they can hedge it. All of a sudden, you buy another 1,000, now they're going to want a little higher price. At some point, you're going to get to the spot where even Citadel says, I'm not selling you the next 1,000, or it's going to be, instead of $2, it's going to be like $8.
Right.
It just gets to the point where people can't sell it.
Crush options, maybe there were 3 or 4 players in that market. That was it.
Yep.
And when we stopped selling, that was it. No more. And people would be shocked when they would come in and say, what's the market? 6 bid at infinium or infinity. We're not going to sell them.
Well, at like the VIX, 26 is a big number. But if it gets to 40, don't be surprised if the next tick isn't 50.
Yeah.
Because the reason why, it's not linear. I'm just saying, we actually... A couple of them that they were long the VIX 2-3 months ago. Well, and it didn't go anywhere. You know, be nice to have it. VIX calls.
Russell, Russell's a good one on anything and everything VIX, right?
Yeah, we had somebody who last week we talked about some.
And now the MIAX they're creating their own volatility index. I think it's called Spikes. That's an interesting one to follow.
We don't really need another. All the volatility is the implied volatility option. You can trade the Qs. You don't need the VIX. All it is a calculation of what the volatility is. But you should know that before you make the trade. Or if you have a decent broker, you should be able to say, by the way, what volatility am I paying for these options? Right. Same thing as the VIX.
Yeah.
But it's not where. Probably the biggest expert on the VIX is Russell.
Right.
Our Wednesday guest. He wrote a book on it. It's the best one out there by far. Russell is a genius when it comes to this stuff. But it basically is the implied volatility. All right, I suppose we should say it.
Of the wings.
No, there's a formula going out. But it doesn't really matter. It's the option you're buying or selling. If you put an option pricing model in there, okay, if you say you use the... what's the one that most people use? Black-Scholes. Then there's Cox, Rubenstein. There's a bunch of others. But if you know all the variables, usually the variable you don't know is the volatility, because it's kind of a plug variable. All the rest of them you know. You know the time to expiration. You know the price of the stock. You know the interest rate, probably. Whether they pay a dividend or not. Those sorts of things. So those other variables kind of get covered. The other one is the volatility, which is a plug variable because they needed it. It worked out mathematically, but it also has its weaknesses. But the point, if you know the price of the option, and you know the other variables, you can work backward to determine what the VIX would have to be to get you that option price, correct?
Yep.
What people will say, IBM is trading at a 22. That means if you look at the price of the option and back it up through the model, that equals a 22 volatility. Right. So that's the way it kind of works on that stuff. So when you talk about implied volatility, you need to know what you're buying or selling. in most cases. Because a lot of times, I mean, I used to explain how, you know, Dr. J would get on TV and talk about all the, you know, these people are buying 90 bazillion of the X calls or puts or whatever. And, you know, because I did some subcontract work for a lot of those people, they'd say, well, gee, I want to do the same thing John's doing. And I said, well, how do you know what John's doing? Well, he just said he talked about this option. I said, I guarantee you, because I'm the guy who kind of taught John, if somebody is pushing some option way up or way down,
volatility is going up too.
Look, but he's going to look for the option that is maybe hasn't moved yet, the cheapest one. He's going to buy that one and sell the one to the schmoes that were buying it. Right?
Yeah.
So if somebody's going to buy, say, let's pick a stock, Cisco, it's trading like 64. If somebody's going to buy a bazillion of the 70 calls in January and whatever volatility they're pushing, and I say, wow, those things are kind of high, first thing I'm going to do is look
buy
for the
all the 60s or 65s.
Or I'm going to look at the February 70s or something.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to find something to buy so the next time somebody comes in and pays too much for those, I can sell them to them. It's not, it's just because you say this is the one that's being traded, it's probably the least one you want to buy, right?
Right. That's the one that they're running up.
Yeah.
So you figure out a good way to sell that,
right,
and then all of a sudden you can sell to the demand.
Sometimes there's kind of no hedge, though, because you'll see stuff like in the GLD, which is 267, it's the gold. You know, somebody will come in and buy like the 360s next November. You know, I don't know what you do with those. You know, I mean, and most of the time, I'm going to say just about all the time when I was looking at the raw numbers on this stuff, they just give away the dough. I mean, it's some kind of, it's like, or somebody comes in like the VIX is 25, somebody will buy the 70 VIX in like November or something. You sit there and go, all right, it's hard to hedge. I mean, it's ridiculously hard to hedge.
That might be a hedge for them.
Well, yeah, but I mean, there's a lot of pain between 25 and 70.
Right.
I mean, it's the same way in the gold. You got, if you're short it, there's a lot of room for $100, right?
Right. Right.
What do you make of the relationships between the Bitcoin and all the other stuff that you trade, the soybeans and the are they these commodities just one-offs now?
A lot of people would like it to be classified as a commodity. Some people want it to be. Means a whole lot of things to a whole lot of people. Meaning, Bitcoin is really, it's still what you want it to be. I mean, there's no true guidance yet. We've got the ETF, but I mean, it's another product that has high volatility. So
you don't like my idea it's a fake stock?
I mean, it may be, I don't know if it's a stock, but it's definitely an asset class, and the people who
What's
are
the
in
asset?
It, the asset is digital money.
Okay.
So
what's the money worth?
I don't know.
That's the point.
That's what we're trying to figure out. And we've got it moving 24 hours a day. You know,
I think it's worth nothing. It's the tulips without the tulip. That's just me.
Yeah, I mean, you think it's worth nothing. The Russians and the North Koreans think it's worth everything.
Good luck with that.
Digital people are all over it. You know, it's whatever you want it to be. So it definitely is an asset class, and it moves similar to something like oil or I don't even know what. It's the volatility is way more than some of the metals. Maybe it's like natural gas. You know,
well, you can't start the conversation usually before somebody locks in, drops into this blockchain thing. Blockchain is from what Kevin everybody says, it's an amazing advancement. Problem is, you don't own the blockchain. Do you? Bitcoin, you know anything like that? It's not like somebody owned the system and you could buy the system. I'd be a big buyer of that, right?
Yeah, I don't know how you would.
One
of those computers is going to figure out how to crack the blockchain eventually. But
I have a feeling it's not that far off because it.
Yeah, we have no idea. You know, it's impossible to predict the future. So, what do? I don't know. Just trade it like anything else.
I don't know if it's all that impossible to predict the future, to be honest with you. When I say that, I'm talking about...
People will make bad decisions. That's my extent of predicting the future.
My view of the future is that you can... People's behavior never really changes over... Hell, all you do is read Greek tragedy. It's the same thing, right?
Right. Over and over again.
Over and over. And again, I'm not giving any investment advice on the Bitcoin stuff because all it's done is gone up and I've said, I don't like it. So it's not like you wanted to listen to me. But it's... I get this idea that... nobody can ever crack this thing. And somehow, some way, you know, somebody wandered out of the temple near the Kung Fu temple and did this for people and walked back up in the hills and never be seen again. And it's somehow you can lose your password and 20 years from now, nobody will find a way to steal your Bitcoin that nobody's come across in 20 years. I find that amazingly hard to believe, Greg. I don't see how that... People are smarter than that.
Well, the market's pretty smart. I mean, the volatility in Bitcoin is, what, 75% or 70%? Yeah. So, you know, it could easily fall 70% in a year, and that wouldn't be surprising to... So...
Explain to me this. How does the government... When we talk about these passwords, nobody can get their password back, and yet the government seizes them, how do you put Bitcoin in essentially street name? I mean, if you buy it through Coin or somebody like that, How do you put Bitcoin in street name? Do you have to give them your password, or does it go under theirs and you somehow write a contract that says they got to give it back to you? How does that work? I mean, what I'm talking about, if you buy a stock through PTI or Merrill Lynch or anybody and it stays in your account and you don't get the piece of paper, the stock is in your name at RBC, okay, if you're here, or Interactive Brokers, but it's in street name with DTC, correct?
So your stock is being held by the custodian.
Right.
Right.
But now, how does that happen in Bitcoin if everybody's got an individual password?
So are you talking about seized?
Yeah, I mean, how does the government, because you're a sleazebag, how do they steal your Bitcoin? What if you go to your def without giving them your password? How do they get it? How do they get access to it?
I mean, it depends on where the Bitcoin is. I would guess it's where it's stored.
But if you went to a vending machine 10 years ago and put $10,000 in the vending machine, and now it's worth $200,000, how do they get that?
If they have like the digital drive or the hardware, they can extract. If it's not encrypted, then you know you can pull it off pretty easily. I'd imagine whoever is being seized, there's a court order against them too, so they're
who are you gonna call up in the Bitcoin world?
No, I'm talking about they have to give it up. If they don't, you know, that's a problem with the court, or a bigger problem with the courts. But I think just the if you can access their computer and or their drive, the physical drive, you can pretty much grab it from the RAM because it's not encrypted.
When my bro comes in and he just to see if one of the Bitcoin vending machines worked, I don't know how many years ago, he put $20 in there and he got like $15 worth of Bitcoin. Of course, the fee was like $5. We should have bought one of those things. And he forgot his pay. He has no chance of getting his $15, probably worth $30 now. He has no chance of getting it. How's the government going to get it?
Well, if they have the physical hardware, it's a lot easier, especially if it's not encrypted. If they don't have it, and they don't, and... You know,
you mean your desktop? When you say physical hardware, you mean your desktop?
Yeah.
Okay, he got water through a vending machine. How the hell is it?
And then he's got a password. And if he doesn't have the password.
But he doesn't know what it is.
Right, right. Then it's just gone.
Well, allegedly gone. I'm saying it's not gone. Somebody's going to find it.
Maybe. It's not like. It'd be real hard for them to go to the whatever company. And they could maybe find the transaction on the blockchain, but they can't force him to give the password.
Yeah, I find this amazing because Kenny and I had this discussion a couple of Tuesdays ago, and he said it's going to be regulated. And I go, Kenny, how's it going to be regulated? He goes, well, they're going to regulate. I said, okay, I'm not giving you crap here, but who's they? I mean, PTI Securities is regulated. If NFA or FINRA wants to call up, they call up my brother Dan and say, this is what we need. With Bitcoin, there's nobody to call up. How do you regulate?
Well, if you have, say, a Coinbase account, they could just order Coinbase. I mean,
if it's in this kind of they're part of street name, yes.
Yeah. So if that, it's so just what, how call do, so it cold storage.
So how does physical? All right. So how does the cold? How does
you can't make them. You can't read minds and make them give you the password, or maybe they don't even know it. Then it's just gone.
All right. Next question. Because let's see what you're doing to me. You'll open up even more questions. If my Bitcoin is at Coinbase,
be careful not to bore the people too much.
I know. Well, I mean, I think people are, a lot of people that we know are involved in this stuff. But I'm saying if your Bitcoin is at Coinbase, so it's in some sort of street name, and the government seizes it, like they did with the, what's his name, the guy from the Bahamas. Now, does Bitcoin allow the government then to get a new password? How does that work?
I don't think it's Bitcoin. I think they would go to the exchange itself and then grab the documents and or the physical drives and say, all right, this is ours now, and then crack it. Get into it.
All right. I'd interest
that would be a lot easier than having someone not give up their password. I mean, they would have to use one of those quantum computers and try to run all the combinations and all that. I don't know how long that takes, but it's hard, at least right now.
Well, you know, I think that if you have an account at PTI or any place, Lakeside Bank, Chase Bank, you name it, if they can't find you, I don't know the dates. They can't find you. If we send you PTI, send you a statement, and all of a sudden the statement starts coming back, return to sender, and we can't track you down in, like, I don't know if it's 90 days, 180 days or something, we, meaning RBC or the bank or somebody, has to kick your stuff to the state. So there's one set of rules for, like, the real world, and how does Bitcoin Forever not have to do that if they want to become part of the world?
Again, these are all brand new questions, and it's part of the volatility. Why the volatility is 75%?
That's probably right.
I mean, there's no reason. I try to think of the nightmare scenario, in kind of what happened with FTX was the nightmare scenario, where everything, even the asset in general, was kind of, they were trying to think of, you know, well, if this exchange goes down, what happens? And you saw what happened in real time. People just kind of panicked out of most of what they have, and that was a huge problem for that.
Well, God, if you ever said
asset class,
somebody cracked into this thing, how fast would people sell?
I think it would be the exact same as the FTX problem. I mean, they saw it, and it was ugly.
Well, I was gonna ask you last week. Let's shift topics just a little bit. Why, out of all, you know, kind of the tension going on in the world, why is oil $67? Just because people are making or producing so much oil, it's just that's where the supply and demand has it.
I'd imagine that this current downdraft was more related to the supply increase expectations from OPEC, as well as less demand from whatever kind of quote, you know, slowdown we're anticipating here in the equity markets.
What
you can always see, usually, if people get spooked about the economy, crude oil usually is one of the first indicators.
Well, with all the kind of craziness going on in the rest of the market, isn't it sort of unusual if the oil traders are the guys sitting on their hands? They sort of are, aren't they?
Yeah, that's when energy, I mean, a lot is determined by season, too. You can here, at least, you know, the heating oil really has dominated the past 2 months just because of the winter, you know. And I'd imagine with Trump saying drill, baby, drill every couple days, that's, you know, they've already seen this and they know exactly what he wants to do, and they're not going to get caught long a bunch. So when people want to sell, it's including the Saudi government, and they've got, I don't even know their break-even, but their break-even price is way higher now. But, like...
Well, when you say break-even, it's not the break-even, it's a pump. It's a break-even by the time they pay everybody all for their jets and stuff. It's kind of a different break-even.
Yeah, and they've got massive projects going on over there. So the fact that they're pumping more and still doing that, and, I mean, there's a lot of...
If you pump oil out of the ground at $20 and sell it for $30, most people would say you're cash positive, but if you owe 48 executives $1 million a year and a 30 doesn't cut it, I guess you can say you're not break even, but really you sort of are, aren't you?
I'm not positive. I've heard as high as 80 some dollars for them, and they can't be happy about 67.
Well, they actually, where the hell did I see this? One of the listeners, I think, sent it to me. There's a huge breakdown when you talk about break even over there. They have massive municipal and country budgets. Most of it, not most of it, a lot.
I don't know if you've seen those projects that they're doing between the soccer stadiums and the wine cities, and they're
paying off the fifth cousin, makes like $1 million a year or something.
Yeah, that's not even close to the kind of debt that.
Well,
not
debt, what I'm saying is whether you're building a soccer stadium has nothing to do with whether the oil is being sold for more than it costs you to get it out of the ground. That's right.
Well, calculates into their break even to pay for all their stuff that they're doing. I mean, they're building airports, they're building new cities, they're building huge amusement parks, they're buying soccer teams, all that kind of stuff is, and they're in the name of diversification. Saudi is really, really, you know, spending on everything.
If they can't sell oil at a price that gets them a new soccer stadium, I'm not going to feel real bad about it.
Well, yeah, but. You say, you know, why has oil gotten kind of hammered here?
Well, we have a president that actually was pretty good in the retail business and building, so I think he must know how supply and demand works a little bit, but you don't drill baby drill to drive the prices down. The reason why people drill more is because the price goes up. Is he unclear on that or what?
Never know what's in people's minds, but yep. And when you keep saying drill, baby, drill, if I heard something like that on the ag side, there's no way I'd want to be caught too far along. You know, like you said earlier, what you want to do is kind of be ahead of the game and saying, maybe these people are going to come after the puts. I want to be ready to sell it to them. So you're thinking like that.
Before we go to break, are the soybean, wheat, corn markets, actually, there's been some action in those a little less couple
of
weeks.
Oh, yeah. They're definitely preparing. You
know, is anybody's reaction on the floor? They still do, options are still traded on the floor, right?
Some. Bean prices right now are about $10.20 per bushel.
And they've been up to like $14.15 or something?
Oh, they've been the first Trump tariffs, you know, they went down 20% instantly. Then, call it during Ukraine, when they started the invasion of Ukraine, all those things ran up to 13, 14, all the contracts, not just one. And then, yeah, as high, like you said, $16. But now we're back.
Where do you suppose the actual break even for a farmer is in Illinois? It's about 8 or something?
That depends all on if you own the land or if you're renting.
Well, that's true.
So if you're a land owner, you're probably happy with anything over, you know, $9. That's pretty good. But some people definitely don't own the land and they're paying for it and it gets real tight. University of Illinois does those studies pretty much every year, and they take the cost inputs and they say, you know, this is what it's going to be break even for corn, this is what it's going to be break even for beans, and then the farmers have a pretty good idea too what they need.
Well, you had that study a couple years ago. You said the average farmer made $225, and last year they were supposed to make $65. You have any idea?
Yeah, that flies around because the price of their inputs, and you need to lock in your costs. You know, you can't just sit on
where
everything.
Where is the prediction this year? You have any idea? I know I'm jumping you with this.
Well, tomorrow there's actually a WASDE report that's going to probably affect that pretty.
All right, why don't we go to break? Maybe you can find that, and I'll see if I can find this Atlanta Fed thing, and we'll see if we can track down Mr. Flanagan, who was supposed to call in earlier.
You got it.
SP futures up down 62, sorry. NASDAQ futures down 248. Not looking good here this morning so far. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. A longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR, innovation in human resources. Licensed in Illinois and Arizona.
Stocks, jocks,
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howe. Greg Pappas on the board. S&P futures down 64. NASDAQ futures down 255. I think this is probably about as low as we've gotten. Right, Greg? Said last night I had them down 40 early, and then they came back almost unchanged. Now we're down probably close to the lows. Not sure what all it's being caused by, other than all kind. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff going around, so you can't really put your finger on the one that is actually moving the markets. European markets, which have been actually pretty high. My computer is a little slow here this morning. I'm not sure why that is. Doesn't have its coffee. The individual stocks, every one of the Magnificent Seven is kind of on its butt this morning. I've got NVIDIA down 225. It's down to 110. Meta down 9. Google down 2. Apple down 3. Microsoft down 4.5. Tesla down another almost 8, which is, you know, that's something, right, Greg? I mean, with it, 460 to 254 since November, and there's what is that? $500 billion in market cap or some incredible number? I got the DAX down 176.8%, puts it down 32.4%. Kekron down 29.4%. The DAX has been the most volatile over there because they're trying to expand their economy, and we're going to talk a little bit with John a little bit on how can they really do that without going through the ECB, because the ECB controls the money supply. Now, the Germans obviously such a big piece of the ECB. The question is, do they control the ECB? That's another political question. Well, one question does lead to another, doesn't it? Nikkei up 141.4%. Hang Seng down 447. That's 1.9%. Shanghai down 6.2%. The Japan 10-year bond yield, it's fresh. I won't tell that right now. The 10-year is down 7 basis points to 4.24%. The mortgage rates are actually down a little bit. We'll have Nancy on later to talk about that. The Bund down 4 basis points, 2.79. Japan, however, is up 4 to 1.56, which I guess is a 10-year high. Not an all-time high, but a 10-year high. Oil up 34 cents, but still 67.38. Brent up 34 cents, 70.70. Natural gas up 20 cents, 4.60, which is kind of odd because we're going to be 60 degrees here today. RBOB up a penny, 2.12. Gold down 8 bucks, 29.05, still over 2,900, but doesn't look like it's challenging 3,000 here, at least not anytime soon. Silver up a dime, 32.91. Copper down 3 cents, 4.68. Foreign exchange, and this has been volatile. We got the euro is now up to 108. It was 104. I'm going to say 3 weeks ago, Greg. That's a huge move. British pound 129. Again, that's way up as well. Dollar's been getting hammered. Crypto, Bitcoin is down 137. Had a big move yesterday. It's down to 82,529. What do you got for us, traffic, weather, sports?
Yeah, morning, everybody. It is 6:43 here. We got 42 degrees in Chicago. We have sun, wind, and a high of 64 today. So it is going to be really nice as long as you've got your windbreaker on. Phoenix 53 right now, partly sunny today, high of 84. Traffic inbound Kennedy from Montrose is 11 minutes. Edens from Lake Cook is 24 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf, 22 minutes. Inbound Ryan from 95th is 20 minutes, and the Stevenson from I-294 to the Ryan is 24 minutes. Sports-wise, we had Phoenix, the Suns beat the Mavericks. That was 125 to 116. That's about it. That's all I got, Chief.
Well, I've got the Atlanta Fed. Well, first of all, do we have Jan? Jan, you're there, but you're very low. Unmute thyself.
Can you hear me?
Yep. Okay. Don't you hate it when you mute yourself? Can you hear me?
I'm unmuted.
Right, but we hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, we're good. Okay, so I'm looking here at this GDP now that the Atlanta Fed does, and they're down to, what the hell are they? Their latest is down 2.4%. Didn't they start? This is the first quarter annualized. Didn't they start at the end of January a positive 2 or something, Greg? They're down like 4.4% in the last couple of weeks. I mean, this is a massive drop off. But one thing nice about these guys, I'm not saying they're correct, but John, I don't know if you ever looked at this, but they actually give you a reason why they did it. Imagine that, the government doing something like that. The GDP now model estimate for real GDP growth in the first quarter, blah blah blah, is minus 0.24% on March 6th, up from minus 2.8% on March 3rd. So actually, we're getting better. After recent releases, the Institute of Supply Management, the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis, whoever those guys are, and the U.S. Census Bureau, the now cast of the first quarter in real personal consumption, blah blah blah. So they actually tell you when all these nondescript stuff comes out, like the Philly Fed and Empire State and the one that's here, they'll actually tell you which one of those caused their estimate to move, which is, I think, kind of refreshing, isn't it? Instead of just, unlike price of the PCE to the Fed users, we give you no detail. So anyway, these guys are down to a negative first quarter. I don't know what kind of price adjustment they put in there, but it's a pretty big move. I don't know if I've ever seen a move quite like this in 8 weeks, Jan. I don't know whether this is all these little surveys they come out. What do you think? Is this legit, or are they getting these little surveys sometimes don't match up with what actually happens?
Yeah, well, I think it's hard to collate all this stuff into a single story or a single trajectory. But it's, you know, one thing about, you know, this kind of stuff, there's no shortage of information. The problem is how dependable it is, and are there inconsistencies in it that nobody can explain or account for that just kind of sit there and make you think, well, maybe we need better data, but it isn't maybe so much that we've got a shortage of data by any means.
No, I mean, I think I'm sensing a little bit of a slowdown. I mean, the labor numbers Friday, I think Carl said they would not have picked up any of the government layoffs yet. That might, some of those layoffs would be this month, right?
Yeah.
Because I mean, the Challenger Grain Christmas, is it Christmas? That's a Challenger Grain. Somebody.
Christmas, yeah.
They came out with something the last week of the month and had a bunch of layoffs last month, but now that would not be in the other job things. Plus, that January adjustment is such an outlier that it's kind of hard to even figure out what you're doing after that, isn't it? I mean, we went through that on Friday.
After the holiday stuff.
Yeah. Hey, I want to ask you a constitutional law question since you are one of our legal beagles. Canada is putting this tax on electricity coming this way. Now, would that count as an export tariff?
I think so. I mean, I can't distinguish it from one.
I can't either. I just wonder because it's in our Constitution, export tariffs are banned in the Commerce Clause, correct?
Yeah.
Now, obviously, Canada's are not, or else they are making exceptions just to screw with us or whatever. But I thought a lot of their Constitution kind of came from ours, but maybe not that piece, huh? I'm not saying they're wrong or anything. I'm just saying it's a little. I mean, states do that here, right? They charge other states for stuff coming out. I mean, but definitely in the Commerce Clause, we cannot have an export tariff, correct?
No, that's my understanding. Yeah.
And now they're good.
If you want to think of it as a tariff, what this does then, of course, for the consumer, If this is still the source that you're going to go to, or the distribution system or whatever is going to rely on Canadian power for a segment of the population, those people are going to get gouged pretty bad. They don't have alternatives. That's one of the problems with energy, at least the way we've developed our policy anyway. We don't have things we can resort to when other stuff becomes unavailable. If solar doesn't work, we don't have a nuclear plant, up and running to take, heat off of that. So we're not in a position to bargain, and the consumer certainly is. You pay whatever, you know, it's what you've always said about tariffs. The tax is not on anything other than the consumer at this end. So this has got some real dislocations for people for something like energy, which they have to have.
Well, just kind of to not beat this up, but the difference would be a regular old tariff, an import tariff.
We've done it before, though. I'm not sure.
What?
The export tariffs.
We have.
We banned oil embargo. That was...
It's not a tariff.
That's
an embargo.
That was, that was limiting foreign access to U.S. crude.
I understand that, but the difference is you as a widget manufacturer, if you go to sell widgets to Germany, it's banned in the Constitution for us to charge you a fee for selling them to Germany. That's what's banned. It's very narrow definition, I think. They cannot do that.
Because you can do the same thing, though, exporting.
Can't.
You can make it illegal to export.
That you probably can do, but it's not the same. One is a charge.
Well,
one's considered
in the price world, you know, it's the same thing.
No, it isn't, because one is considered a tax. The government cannot consider that tax revenue like going forward. The big difference.
I mean, the price is going to go up.
I understand that. Well, but anyway, an import tariff. If you buy a Mercedes and you have a tariff on a Mercedes, the Mercedes comes in at $20,000, it's a 10% tariff. Somebody's paying $2,000 to the government at the point of entry, correct, John? Somebody is probably going to be you. Now, Mercedes could drop the price to 21, but now the tariff's still going to be, or drop the price to 19, but now the price is going to be 19, the tariff's going to be 1900 and not 2000, right?
I mean, Canada does it with lumber. They self-impose it just so we won't tax them more.
What I said is we cannot do that. An export tariff is banned by the Constitution. Now you keep telling me that it isn't, but it is. Why don't you go look at the Commerce Clause?
You can do the same thing. The government can do the same thing.
It might be banned in one way, but it's definitely not banned.
We're
not talking about wiggle arounds and other kinds of ways. I'm saying these guys are imposing a tariff on exported electricity, which we are banned from doing. Now, whether...
Maybe broadly, but we can put it as part of a national security thing and do whatever we want.
No, you can't. That's the thing you can do.
You
can say you can't.
The government will do that if it gets...
John, what is it about these younger guys? There's no such thing as a law in their mind because everybody gets around it. That's true. I agree with you on that. But just as... For points of discussion... That's something we could not do here. We could.
In general, you can't do it, but targeted, they can target.
No, you can't.
Okay.
John, where am I going wrong here?
I'm not even a lawyer, and I know this.
It's not a level playing field. Canada, we can. I think you agree there, and it's likely to get even more interesting with the new guy, Carney, than even it was under Trudeau. We shall see.
Greg, you're right, and the people can sort of get to the same place, especially with the person we have in the White House. But the fact is, we cannot come out tomorrow and say we are putting an export tariff on Jack Daniels that goes to Canada. That's banned by the Constitution. Am I right, John, or not? I'm just being simple.
That's my understanding.
Now the question is, does electric in the grid, does that constitute a export? I'm saying it probably does, doesn't it?
Yeah, I would say so.
Now,
I don't think there's a similar ban in Canada that, though, you know, as a device to, you know, put a stranglehold on the flow of energy to the U.S.
Well,
that wouldn't surprise me at this point.
Would you guys think that when you're in these grids? I mean, this is the weird part of this grid. Greg, we've talked about the grid forever, but there's this electrical system that sometimes it doesn't go to the whole country, but there's some states. They're all kind of joined together, right? I mean, we're joined up with Indiana and Wisconsin, those kinds of places. And so if you enter power into the grid, if it's hotter than hell in Chicago and it's not in Wisconsin, we can purchase extra, or the grid can now input extra power from Wisconsin, right? And it's just like we have it here.
Yep.
So
yep.
I wonder when the grid with Canada was first put together, is if it was just for emergency times when one thing led to another, and all of a sudden either they needed power or we needed power, and it would be able to transfer back and forth. I wonder if it's kind of morphed into they always supply power here. It sounded like, from the couple articles I read, which weren't all that detailed, that they're at the point now where they're like always supplying power to New York and Minnesota and stuff. Is it?
Yeah, I read that somewhere this week.
Is that because we let some of our nukes lapse and we let some of our stuff here? Or has it always been like that? They just sold it to us.
Well, depending on what transmission routes we've got or have maybe haven't maintained or whatever, it probably is more efficient and stable to get it from Canadian sources in those contiguous states anyway. Maybe even beyond the contiguous states for all I know. It wouldn't surprise me. I mean, the situation with the grid in this country is kind of a scandal from what I know of it.
Well, it's sort of weird. I haven't seen him in ages. When I say one of my buddies, there's a lot of people you haven't seen since COVID, right? The lady who works for is a bartender and Saturday or on Sunday, her dad graduated with us at Notre Dame. John, matter of fact, but talk about making you feel old. He was the left tackle on the '73 championship team. Nice guy. I met him a few times. Anyway, she marries this guy, Bobby, terrific dude, and he's a high wire guy. You know, talk about a real job. I don't think you'd want that. You know, you have to go to boot camp for that for like a month. And he says a lot of people love it the first few days, and after 3-4 days in a row, they go, I don't want to do this anymore and quit. Anyway, I asked him, when you drive, ask Russell, when you drive, somehow or another, maybe you can explain this to me. If you drive to Indianapolis or Purdue or something, there's a spot in Indiana. Jen, did these guys decide there's just like a lot of wind there or what the deal is? If you go down, all of a sudden you go through this valley, and it's Indiana, so it's not much of a valley. There's got to be how many windmills? 100, 200, 300? They're all over the place. And then there's a pretty breezy day. I could tell because the car was getting pushed around. And you see half of them are off. So next time I see Bobby, I go, how come these things on a windy day are off? And he goes, it was 65 degrees. The electric need was like next to nothing. Commonwealth Edison doesn't need them. They turn them off. They're not. I said, yeah, but they're wind. Why wouldn't you have those in the daytime? He goes, doesn't matter. Because if their stuff is percolating along and the grid is full, you turn them off because they're 50 miles away. There's an awful lot of politics in this. Can you imagine how long it would take us to learn how the workings of these grids and who gets to put what in and sell at various prices? I got to believe that electric power comes on the grid at next to nothing in the middle of the day, wouldn't you think? Yet they didn't want it or don't want it on certain days. So I guess I'm trying to extrapolate that little bit of knowledge to what the grid back and forth to Canada must look like. Are the people in New York now trying to scramble like hell to make as much electricity as they can so they don't have to pay to 25% or what?
Well, that's going to take them a while to fix, and this is just something they can do overnight. Somebody's going to pay. The consumer will pay.
Well, we're not talking about air conditioning drag in the summer. I mean, out of all the times of the year, we got to be getting into the electrical demand. It has to be the lightest right about now, isn't it?
Yeah.
But now we don't even have heat on today, right? It's going to be 64.
It'll be on.
I wonder, this is something Greg is really... I wonder, Greg, if you could find... I'm sure you can find a...
$11 was the break-even price for beans this year.
Really?
Or up to $11.50.
And what are the farmers supposed to be making this year?
Well, right now they can sell it for $10 if they want.
I mean, you get that number, what the average dude makes? Is that out yet?
Oh, that's not out yet. But if your cost is 11 or 11.5 and you're selling for $10, it's not going to look great.
No. That's when you bring what's the joke, the ethnic joke about, we won't say it, ethnic stuff, where the guys go out and buy the Christmas trees for $5 and they come back and sell them for $4, and one guy says, that's okay, next time we'll bring two trucks.
Right.
But they still though, even though you're losing a little bit, you might still plant, right? Because don't you cover...
Or you might have hedged at a higher price and you're not... Or you... there's a lot of ways that you can... finagle and take expenses this year, or maybe invest, and the cash though, it, you still need to get some cash coming in, or else you're...
Well, if you...
Losses will just get bigger for next year.
But if you rent $3 and now you're able to pay $2 instead of nothing, you're still probably going to plant, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, what
corn is...
What's the most you think anybody hedges? When I say hedges, sells futures against their crop. Half?
The most?
Yeah.
People go over. Now, I don't know if they go naked short, but they'll buy puts in...
Well, that's a little different. Now, you know, there actually was a... This is before you were in the business. Dan was still on the trading floor. My brother, that was so before we opened the firm. And
in theory, this is what people should be doing for their equity portfolios, too.
Oh, well, yeah. Because
if you have a cash farm called a stock portfolio, you know, ideally it's producing something. And
Greg, we've gone up for 20 years. What do you need insurance for? The Fed's got your back. The government won't let it go down.
Well, yeah, and a lot depends on, you know, your risk profile and how much you're willing to stomach in terms of drawdowns. So, yeah.
But anyway,
the farmers work the same way as the people.
They're not that big on the puts, because this is back in the late 80s. The government actually had a pilot program to, instead of having crop insurance and all the other stuff, they just subsidized people money to buy puts. And I think it was Dan knows this. It was an Indiana program. John, I don't know if we've ever talked about this before. And after a couple of years, it was one of the most successful programs they ever had, and then they bagged it. Because all the people who were in the crop insurance business and all the other stuff, it's a big hunk of people, right? Right, Greg? That are in all those different other programs.
Very big lobby. Very anything that goes through has got a clear, like,
yeah,
a 10-panel senator.
You know, where it would be a lot easier to just say, okay, we'll give you money to buy the puts, and that's it, right?
Right, right.
Anywho, yeah, Janet, boy, I'd love to see or have somebody on. I don't know if I'd want to study it myself. The choreography of how much Minnesota, New York, and those places now can avoid taking stuff from Canada. I'm gonna bet that there's spots in New York where they're really dependent on it. Just a suspicion.
Upstate New York, and I think Vermont, New Hampshire too.
Why do you suppose they? Where do they get the stuff in Minnesota? You go north of Minnesota, and Canada, there's nothing there. They have electric plants up there.
They have coal plants over there.
Boy, they got to be. You ever been up there? What you did up there was canoe. Well, the time I was up there. I mean, we're not talking about Toronto and Montreal. I mean, is there anything between essentially Sault Ste. Marie and Calgary, for God's sake?
Well, it's heavily forested. And
I know in New York,
Ontario, well, Manitoba, those are you know, very unpopulated, difficult to navigate places because there's not that many roads. There's railroads, but there's not that many railroads either.
There's like one.
It's densely forested. What I've seen it anyway, just from the train, and that gives you, you know, a sense you don't get from the roads. You see just how little development there is.
15% of New York's...
It's lonely.
What were you saying, Greg? 15%?
Yeah, in New York, I know that 15% of their energy comes from the hydro that is coming straight from Canada. So
okay, from like the falls and stuff? Wow.
Yeah. I'd imagine it's way more for Maine and Vermont and those. I mean, they've got even bigger plants and... Probably, you know, north of 25 or 30%. I'd imagine Maine and Vermont.
Well, when we went to we were at Manitoulin Bay up in Lake Huron with a client back in the early 90s, and the son says, "Well, you know, if you didn't turn right, if you turn left, first of all, the road would dead end, and if you're able to keep going, you'd meet moose and mosquitoes all the way to Hudson's Bay. There's nothing there."
Oh yeah, yeah.
That's a bizarre world. But so, John, what a lot of the stuff that we see coming out of Washington is causing markets to go up and down, actually sort of mainly down. And it's kind of weird, Greg. You'll hear people on the radio or TV say they equate volatility with down markets. It's not similar. market could be volatile going up or volatile going down or volatile staying even, right? Volatile is how much it changes from day to day. Or actually in the middle of the day, although nobody keeps track of that.
We do.
Well, you don't see historical intraday numbers usually. And I'll bet most firms, maybe some firms do, but what I'm saying here is if you have IBM, for instance, which is, you know, fairly steady. If IBM, today it's 259.60, if tomorrow it's 261, it's a $1.40 move. Right, Greg?
Right.
If it trades 270 and back down to 240, it ends up unchanged. If you look at the numbers 40 years from now, it's going to say it's unchanged, correct?
Unchanged. But you will see that higher volatility.
What we're seeing now is, well, in the gold thing on Friday, and this, well, I'm pissed off about this, we have a lot of positions in the GDX, which the gold miners. The thing trades almost 42.5. So we were sort of geniuses. We sold there, right, for everybody because we had some more long some calls. The thing immediately plummets down to like 41. And then the 41 calls are trading like 16 cents, and I'm going, you know, you don't want to do this kind of stuff on retail accounts necessarily, although if it's a winner, nobody complains. I said, you know, this thing can pop right back up here, even though it looked horrible. Sure enough, they closed 85 cents. I'm going, oops, missed wow. That one. I'm like, and that's what's happening. But at the end of the day, I think it was down a dime, right? And yet it had almost a $1.50 play. That's weird, huh?
It's a little schizophrenic.
Yeah.
And you can't decide what it wants. That goes back into the volatility, what we were talking about earlier.
But I'm saying it's even more volatile than the day-to-day is letting you believe, correct?
Yep. And that'll show up in the implied volatility numbers that you're looking at intraday.
Well, John, when do you think this all ends?
Well, we're not, you know, beyond scratching the surface of the stuff that's, you know, going to come down the road, I suspect. And part of it is, you know, people were so geared up in the last, you know, election cycle for change because they felt that things had just kind of collapsed around, that the country was so much on the wrong track. So they're expecting, and maybe not fully expecting what that means now, as far as, you know, how unrecognizable things could get for very long. And I think it's going to be a tough year for Trump, ultimately, and a tougher year for the Democrats, it seems, to get their equilibrium such as it is back. But I think we're in kind of a different environment now where we expect, you know, all this tumult and change to a point, and yet we're not, you know, maybe too happy with the results yet. There'll be probably blowback before we're through if things went too fast, too suddenly for people. But without that, you know, the country was not in a good place last fall.
And well, you can only drive that so far. And I'm not, you know, don't really want to get into like a political discussion, but I had one of these guys, he's an accountant, comes in Wednesday night. He wanders in because he knows Bill Murphy and I are usually around. And he said, I said something about the markets are a little crazy. And he goes, anything is better than the last 4 years. And I go, anything's a big word, bud. I don't know that the last four years, I was not happy with some of the directions the Democratic Party was headed. I mean, and still am not. Anything encompasses a lot. It's like always and never, right? Those are big words. And I just was looking at, I go to YouTube and look at, I get a lot of statistics from the markets and so forth, and some of these people have put these graphs on YouTube now. So I see one, there's some kind of liberal guy, and you know, it's amazing, John, on both the conservative and the liberal side, the headlines, if you actually listen to it, the content doesn't come close to proving the headline.
Right.
But this one dude did have a bunch of people he's interviewing that are getting canned from government. And a lot of them voted for Trump 3 times and are serious Trumpers. And they're like, I didn't know he was going to fire me type of thing. Oops. And then Saturday I'm listening to these farmer guys. Evidently there's, I don't think about this, maybe Greg does, but there's stuff you do for, what's the word when you for the environmental things we do to help the environment out, where you do that, you front the money. I have no idea what the type of things they're talking about. And then when you prove that you did it, the government sends you a check. I don't know what those are, but farmers all, I'm gonna say virtually all have won for Trump. Well, part of the must thing is we're not paying any of those checks. We don't know what those are. So he's got, I mean, some of this stuff is pissing off their base, for God's sake. I mean, how far can you go with that? Yeah, no. I mean, normally you and I'd be careful with that, wouldn't we?
Yeah, well, I think there's a a tipping point where the change that you wanted or demanded starts to get close to home, and it isn't the kind of change you were hoping for or expected it. But this is, I can see why your friend said, anything is better than what we've had. That's how cynical and desperate and fatigued everybody had become. So there's no way you can have a rejection of all of that without disruptions and dislocations and shocks that people, weren't at all prepared for. So a real revolution like what Reagan attempted 40 some years ago is not a smooth process. It's not in a linear direction all at the same time. It's very much a hit or miss, and a kind of stab in the dark for people. And to a point, people are okay with that. Even the people who see that maybe this is getting close to home for me, I better start burnishing my resume and do something else. There's always that possibility when you've got government as the the reason behind it, all the problems we've got. And of course, that's an old mantra. And the Republicans succeeded with it. It never really shrank government. So we never really found out how much they were able to do or willing to do. Now it's different because there's more government and NGOs and administrators all over the place than we ever had, and we've really kind of grounded.
Jan, we don't. Somewhere in this whole mess, even though we have people that are pretty darn bright listening to this stuff, but we have people that have zeroed into where they believe their side and not the other side, and when you actually check the facts, in a lot of cases, neither side's telling you the truth. I mean, I don't think there's very. I mean, we think. I mean, let's put it this way: the right is willing to buy into this NGOs that somehow or another the government's way bigger than it was. Yet, if you look at the actual numbers coming from the Fed of government employees, now, granted, NGOs are people that are outside of that. We're not even back up to the number when Clinton took office. Now, when you say we've got all these NGOs, I'm going to say that we do, and it's a problem, and they're not being counted, and I'm with you on all that stuff, but the implied the implied arithmetic thing you're trying to talk me into, that's a bad way of talking about it. The assumption is there was no such thing, nothing like an NGO when Clinton took office. I don't know that to be true. There probably was some way of subcontractors or whatever. Maybe there wasn't, but I mean, why would I make that assumption, or why would you? I mean, it could be true, but neither one of us know, do we?
No, I think it's possible, to come up with a kind of profile. Certainly the change that's taken place since the Reagan years and the Clinton years, there was an attempt to pare things down.
Attempt, 280,000 people is more than an attempt.
Yeah, well, I mean, they were trying to, out-Republican the Republicans. That was the key to Clinton's success. And this is after, with the savings and loan fallout under Bush 1 and, Desert Storm and other stuff that people were kind of like getting battered back and forth about. Clinton seemed to come like somebody who really did have his handle on how bloated and inefficient things were becoming, and it's because Reagan skated on that. All that talk that Reagan gave us never went anywhere, except kind of bankrupting the country by cutting taxes and then not shaving any of the fat off the government. So we're playing catch up on that and have been for the last, you know, four decades. What it will look like, I don't know. It isn't even so much maybe the numbers anymore, but it's the power that a lot of these agencies have, you know, assumed, you know, legitimately or not. So it doesn't even take a lot of people, or, you know, or grunt workers to put the whole system out of whack. It's just all the stuff has been delegated to these agencies.
I don't think anybody on either side of the aisle, well, there might be a few on the Democratic side, but I don't think anybody agrees with that. I mean, that's the way. I sure don't. I mean, I see it happen in my industry. I think Congress should actually write out what they sort of want to have done, which isn't to say that there isn't going to be any. I mean, they're going to delegate something to the SEC. They're not going to go through every little fine rule, but it, I think it, to a lot of people's extent, it's gone way overboard to where they don't even check up. I mean, I remember asking the question to the lady who was the rep from the North Shore, Bean, I think was her name. So you got all these bank mergers going on in 2008. I said, is anybody reviewing any of these deals from Congress? And she looked at me like I had four heads. I don't remember. I think she might have been a Republican. She goes, why would we do that? And I go, she goes, we delegated that. But boy, I said, some of these deals look pretty good to me. I mean, it's a lot of money flying around. You're picking up $80 million of loans in this one place and $120 from the other. You're doing that for people, and you're giving them the cherry to the rest of the place. I mean, why wouldn't somebody review that? I mean, I didn't want to argue with her, but yeah, I did. I mean, what do you mean? You have to look at it. And
if you take the Department of Education as kind of a glaring example of this, I have no idea of the size of the federal bureaucracy for that department. But what I do know is the culture that you know, whole operation has fostered is that you've got a bloat in every local school system, at least in the state of Illinois, and I suspect in every state, where there are as many administrators in a school these days as there are teachers, and probably a lot more of both of them than they have students.
I'll bet that's very uneven. I'll bet some places are not bloated and some are.
But you know, it's probably worse in the prosperous districts than it is in the I can't say for sure, but I suspect the whole culture now from the top down, it doesn't take a big bureaucracy to enforce this if all the bureaucracies down the road buy into this. Of course, this is how, you know, tax money is spent these days. It's supporting just ridiculous allocations of people.
But how many people who are going along with this get rid of the Department of Education have any idea what they even do?
Well, that's one of the reasons I think it is disposable.
Well, just because people are ignorant. I mean, we had a question was asked. What was his name? Tom. Who was the speaker after the big Tom Foley? Actually, gave a breakfast talk at the CBOE, and people were asking questions. And one of the very conservative, you know, I did it all myself kind of traders, what's with this Department of Education? You know, why aren't you doing this or why aren't you doing that? And he said, well, you know, in the U.S., I mean, Foley, of course, had all the numbers. He goes, we have something like how many thousand different education authorities in this country? And he goes, that's the way we've always been. He goes, the Department of Education, they didn't mandate it as much back then, so I kind of like the way they were back then more than I do now, so I'm with you on that. He said, but all we do from our end is we help, if there's some areas that don't have any books, we'll help with books, we'll help with this. He goes, in France, he says to the guy, by the way, do you know how the system is in France? And of course, the guy knew nothing. And he says, you know, in France, every student in France in the fourth grade on the 15th day of fourth grade is studying the same chapter in the same book. He goes, do you want us to be like that? And the guy goes, well, hell no. And he goes, well, neither do I. So you're asking me about education. That should be, those kinds of things should be local. I shouldn't be doing that. And I don't want to do that, he says to the guy. Now, where it's gone from them with some of these other mandates and so forth, especially some of the sex stuff and things, I don't think anybody's not with you on that, John. I mean, I never was that part of that, whatever progressive movement that was. But that doesn't mean that the department, that there aren't some things in terms of books and other stuff to where you try and even out a little bit some of the poorest areas from the richest. I don't think that that's a bad thing if you do it in a calculated, normal manner. Now, you're always going to have New Trier with 48 gyms and a hockey rink and all the other stuff, and Inglewood not. I mean, I guess that's You know, I don't know why. I mean, because we just, those areas get to vote that kind of money. And, you know, it's funny, my mom, well, you know, my mom, we lived in Evergreen Park. And for a long time, whenever there was a vote came up, they had more, this sounds awful, John, they had more old people than they did have people with families. So whenever they came up with something, you know, $10 million for like a second football team, it would always get voted down. Until one, in some areas, the people with the kids, essentially, it's tyranny of the majority in those cases, right? We want to tax all these old people because we think our kids need a new soccer field. And the parents are like, the old people are going, I didn't, soccer field wasn't part of my school experience. I went in there and I learned, I got out and I got a job. They don't need four soccer fields, artificial turf that are $3 million a pop or whatever they cost. But it comes down to who's got the most votes, which really is, you know, it's the old joke. I mean, you got three wolves and a hen voting who to have for breakfast, right? No, democracy is not the best in that regard, is it?
No. The thing about the Department of Education is it turned into this prescriptive organization about, you know, teaching standards, curriculum, performance evaluation, and always catering to the most inefficient constituencies in the education system, the teachers' unions, pretty much. And it's become
there's a lot of places in the country don't even have teachers' unions.
Right, but then in the biggest, you know, cities, and the ones that, you know, the Department of Education takes its cues from are, you know, teachers' unions.
But how much of the Illinois budget comes from them? I'm going to say 5%.
Well, but beyond budget, my point is that they are controlling, you know, how even the state can use its own resources. It determines, you know, objectives for performance. It legislates. I mean, it's like the French system, you know, you were just quoting Foley on. That's what we've turned into. I don't think anybody ever saw that as the goal of the Department of Education.
I don't know that they dictate any curriculum, do they? I mean, I don't know. I'm asking.
They become an instrument for things like No Child Left Behind and all these other initiatives that pit, you know, individual school districts against each other to compete for federal money. But in order to get that money, you've got to, you know, toe the line about what kind of standards they want you to be doing, the kind of books you use, the way you hire teachers, the way you evaluate them.
I don't know if you can't fire them.
This is why it's become a kind of, you know, it's a performance, you know,
well,
act,
okay,
to get, you know, people behind, and it's ruined the teaching.
But I mean,
you're
blaming them, and Musk obviously and Trump are, you know, they don't do anything. They all suck. I would just like, it would take me, and I think all of us should probably go together. I'd like to find out what exactly they did. It sounded like they were in Foley's time, when it was 20 years ago, they essentially tried to have some kind of programs that sort of evened out and helped the individual places out. Now, granted, it's gone to more than that. Should we just, out of the 100 programs they have, should we just say, boy, what are you doing these 24? Stop them. Or are 80 of them no good, or all 100 no good? I don't know, and I'm not willing to take Musk's word for it, who's been there less, probably knows less about it than I do. I mean, you know what I'm saying? I'm still thinking most of all the problems in Chicago are self-derived. I don't see those guys. All the problems I have here with the Chicago Teachers Union, is there one of them I can blame on the Department of Education? Why? It seems to me we've the fleas we have in our own bed here, our own fleas.
Well, I would point to things like, you know, what the government gets out of the Department of Education is a whole national network of ways of hiding the failure on a local level. Because all, you know, a school district like Chicago can say we're living up to the standards. It, you know, they can fudge the numbers to get there, but it isn't about exposing any problems in the system. And the Department of Education, by being carved out of HEW, which is what, back in the 70s, 78 or 79, under Carter, to focus on it as something that required, you know, national directives to improve the system. The system was in trouble then too, of course, especially in big cities. But now it's just become an elaborate, you know, way of hiding just how bad things are.
I think, John, to be honest, I would agree with you guys that they have done the same overreaching crap that they can over the last 20 years as the people in my industry have done. Too many people, nothing better to do, coming up with crap. I mean, I've always agreed with you guys on that. I just, what exactly are they doing that's wrong? Let's get rid of that. And I think the problems with local boards, you know, it's funny, I did a, as you know, I do stupid things. I went out east and I found this truck. And evidently there's a, you ever heard of a town called Clarion, Pennsylvania?
Yeah, I don't think so.
Well, if ever you're driving out east or coming this way, you want to stop there at the Holiday Inn. It's a Holiday Inn Suites place. A real nice bar, good food. Everybody in there is either coming one way or the other. Mind you, like Humphrey Bogart in, where were they, Key Largo or someplace? Where everybody was from somewhere else, just sitting there with a hurricane coming. You got the most incredible observations. And one of the, actually there was this very nice lady sitting next to me, and we're kind of BSing. Where are you from? Chicago. Well, she's from there. And she goes, I'm meeting somebody, which didn't surprise me. And she goes, my brother's coming in. I said, what does your brother do? Well, he's a city manager. And really, so of course, me being me, as soon as he comes in, I kind of shoved her aside. I'm talking to this guy. John, it was fascinating. I talked to him he was a city manager for like a couple of towns, and he was on the board of a few others. He goes, you have no idea how inconsistent these places are. He goes, one place, they put enough money together for their pension. The people who are getting the pensions are getting the right amount. Everything's cool. There's not a dime out of whack. You go 50 feet over in the next town, they had no idea how much they were supposed to put aside. They gave people huge bonuses because they liked them the day they left. They're so deep in hack they can't see straight. And they're just saying it's 5 miles away. It is so inconsistent across the board. You know, I think some of the, I suspect Kevin says that the, like, letting guys play with girls was a Department of Education initiative. That doesn't surprise me, and I don't agree with that at all, but I think, by and large, the Department of Education here stays out of a lot of the local stuff. Now, I don't want them more in, do you? Of course, then again, some of the local places are pretty awful, so should they be allowed to be awful with people's money when other people are better? I don't know. I'm not so sure I know the solution other than have good people all across the board, and how do you do that?
Well, you can't have a national organization in a country set up the way ours is that could do anything really meaningful or useful to the education process other than to provide some kind of, as I said, it's just a way of hiding the failures all throughout the country. And it gives the impression that there's this vast machinery that's keeping track of everything and making sure it doesn't go off the rails, and all it's doing is assisting in going off the rails.
Well, do you have because a problem with standardized testing? I mean, I don't, because otherwise, I mean, how can a lot of parents in certain areas, maybe they should know that their kids are, if there's no standardized testing, how do they know their kids are doing lousy or better in someplace else?
Oh, I'm in favor of standardized testing in a country that buys into merit-based admission and not, you know, a balance of legacy, you know, money contributions, racial profiling, whatever other stuff has gone into it. It makes the standardized testing kind of laughable. It's not usable.
Well, I mean, I'm talking about, what do you think they should, I guess my question is, we'll talk about something else here after the break, but what do you think they should be doing? I mean, I think some kind of book program, some kinds of things like that, some sort of programs where you sort of help out a little bit, the places that don't have any money at all. I don't have a problem with that. I don't have a problem with some standardized testing. Other than that, I don't really want you telling guys to go play with girls. I don't want that. But, I mean, some sort of, there's some, and I don't want them telling everybody we're supposed to be studying the fourth day in fourth grade. But this isn't to say there doesn't need to be some sort of a national thing that at least figures out how everybody's doing. Or we could probably list four things we would like them to do. They'd probably agree on it.
But, and, you know, even when I was a kid, Tommy, you probably saw this too, there were testing instruments that were available to the particular school system, you know, to use. There were a lot of them to shop around for. And they were available, I think, in throughout the United States, but they weren't all mandated in any particular place. And especially if you're in a private school system, you could pretty much choose whatever you wanted. The difficulty, I think, now is standardized testing is the big bugbear of the teachers' unions. They don't want standardized testing, period, because it will expose how little their students are learning. And yet, if you really care about how students can advance into higher ed or, you know, compete in whatever way for a better program than what they're stuck with in their local district, you can't get that under the system we've got. It's so broken that any kind of Department of Education initiative seems designed to
protect. Well, I wouldn't be a bit opposed. I'm not a dictator. I wouldn't be a bit opposed to having a standardized testing that if some kid graduates eighth grade and he can't read, the test pretty much blinks at everybody the kid can't read.
Right, or a civil service exam for a federal job. You know, that worked pretty well when we had it. But that's when the schools were better.
Hey, I never had to take the exam for a janitor, and I was the best janitor there was. Just saying. No exam can tell you that when you use the mop, you got to use your hips. No exam can say.
Well, the PACE exam for entry level government jobs.
Well, you know, but a lot of these people, though, John, actually, we're letting people tell us to be so down on government employees. I mean, the fact is, the CTA, you know, I got issues with how they buy stuff, and I don't know. But by and large, 80% of the people at CTA drive a bus, drive an L. You get on there, they're polite. They don't crack the thing up. They get you where you want to go. I mean, there are a lot of government employees that actually show up and do a good job. And, you know, I mean, it's not like every one of them is useless. And we're sort of, some people are lobbing that out there. I mean, how many CTA buses drive around all day and are on time? And how many of them crack up a month? Like one? It's usually the just saying, hey, what do you say? We're going to break. We'll bring Nancy in. We're down 81 now, John. Are you short spoo? You long puts? I'm not. Actually, we have puts, but we don't have extras. SP Futures down 335. Be right back.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control. Right here, right now. Right here, right now. Right now.
Lower North Bank Stocks and Jacks. I'm talking about Greg Pappas on the board. SP Futures down 84. SP Futures down 349. Greg, this has got to be the low, isn't it? I mean, so far. I mean, we had a nice bounce last night, and then have you been even over there studying some of this stuff? What, you have any idea what the piece of news was that caused the bounce and why in the crap hole here again? I'm not seeing anything.
Fear.
Well, yeah.
Fear.
Over in Europe, we've got the European markets reverse course to trade lower. The DAX down 327, 1.4%. They've been up huge. Again, it's mostly their defense stocks, right, Craig? FTSE down 56.6%. CAC around down 47.6%. They're not down near as much. We're in Asia. We've got the Nikkei actually up 141.4%. Hang Seng, however, down 447. That's 1.9%. Shanghai not doing much, down 6. Call that flat. I mean, those guys have not been in the same drummer for a while now. Bonds down, this is a big move, down 9 basis points, 4.23. The Bund down 5 basis points, 2.79. Japan, however, up 4, 1.56 to a 10-year high. So, since stuff is going crazy. Oil up 38 cents, 67.42, still low. Brent up 37, 70, 73. Greg, as soon as we broadcast the new range was from 70 to 75, here we are at 67. So much for our new range. Natural gas, don't get this one as the country's warming up. up 24 cents, 463. RBOB up a penny, 212. Gold, down 740, was up, but now it's that, 2907. Silver up 9 cents, 3290. Copper down 2 cents, 468. Foreign exchange, again, this is a big mover. The euro is 108.6. It was 104 something 3 weeks ago. That's a 3%, 3.5% move, big move. British pound, 129.3. It was 126.8 for weeks and weeks. In Japan, down 126 to 146.77. Now, again, you got to read that the other way. It's 146 yen to the dollar, not the other way around. Crypto, up 45 bucks, 82,712. But as Greg has reported earlier, they had a session yesterday where they were down like five. So this is even though they're not unchanged today, they're way down from last Friday. Crazy stuff. But Friday, Dow was up 222. S&P was up 31, NASDAQ up 126, a kind of a relief rally. We're reliefing the other way now, like to the point with three times that much. What do you got for us, Trevi, Weather Sports?
Morning, everyone. 7:34 here in Chicago. It is 43 degrees now. Sun, wind, and a high of 64 today. Phoenix, 53 right now. Partly sunny and a high of 84. Traffic inbound Kennedy from Montrose, 19 minutes. Eden's from Lake Cook is 34 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf is 37 minutes. The Ryan from 95th is 28 minutes. And inbound Stevenson from 294 to the Ryan is 30 minutes. Sports, we had big news with Jared Allen's contract. He completely restructured over the weekend. $330 million deal. The league record guaranteed $250 million. So, that's all I got. Back to you.
Your buddy Karl Marx was wrong, Greg. Karl Marx said religion was the opiate of the people. It's actually sports, football.
Sports is religion.
Yeah, do we have Nancy?
Yes, we do.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
All right. We're listening to our discussion here. Where do you think the market has to go to where the football team is going to say, God, we paid that guy how much? John and Nancy, you guys both know, and Greg, that I've always been a little concerned over the last several years. Not so much in the fact that people have money, that's really a good thing. That's what I try and do all day, is make sure my clients have money. The way the wealth piece seemed to be outstripping the income piece has always made me a little nervous. I mean, I never had a problem with John or Nancy's dad making $500 a week, the family living on three, and comfortably, and $200 going in the bank. But it seems like virtually all the wealth lately, except for maybe, you know, people work for banks and so forth and medical places, the wealth seems to be in houses and stocks. And if you don't protect that, you know, easy come, easy go, as Jackie Gleason once said. And I just wonder, I talk to a lot of people that I think should be clients and aren't, some of whom are in their 80s, that have a portfolio they've done exceptionally well with over the last 15 years, and no matter what, they won't move to protect it, even though they'll never make another dime in their life other than Social Security. And it's just a mindset. And if we continue to do this, I really just don't want everybody's wealth to dissipate right in front of their very eyes. And I think it won't go too much further, Nance. One man's opinion, and you feel free to disagree because you know more about it than me. I don't see the market going down another 20% without it affecting housing prices. Because the commercial areas in some areas are already decimated. I don't see how that doesn't affect housing prices, but that's just me. But now I want you guys to tell me why I'm wrong, and I hope I'm wrong. Nance, go ahead.
I don't know. I would assume it's going to affect housing prices. How could it not? How could it not? I mean, if people want to move their homes and they're not moving at a certain price, you've got to lower them. You can only get what the market will bear. So just because last year it was, you know, like last summer it was good, I do not believe the housing market is as good as price-wise as it was last summer. I see prices coming down.
What are you saying on the coast, that's a big problem and it hasn't shown up here yet? Of course, we never had the massive run-up that they did either, right?
Right.
Correct. And Audrey doesn't feel it's happening in our area yet. I'm saying it's location. If it's the right location, maybe not, but in other places, I do see it happening. But that's just one person's opinion. It's not It's not. I can't base it on a fact or a trend. It's just what I have seen going forward. Because I'm actually, you know, you're actually in it. I'm trying to finance it, and we're sitting there saying, what is it going to appraise for? We have no idea. So, and we used to have a better handle on it, because right now we're seeing some areas, you know, like let's say we're in a less desirable school district, that may not carry the same price as, you know, a mile away in a different school district.
How much do you think, you know? Nancy and Jen, that people's view of the future, I mean, when I talk about going back to old times, I mean, I was very young, but my stepfather and my mother bought the bungalow on 102nd Street. It was had to be 1959-ish, 58-ish. And, of course, my stepfather, you know, did a nice job. He didn't save any money, typical guy. And my mom, who had two kids, had saved some money. So they, anyway, they bought a place for like 18 grand. You remember those, you know, I'm sure your parents told you stories, Jen. And, you know, she had the 20% down payment, even though, you know, poor as church mice. But the thought, and they, you know, they scraped together so they would be able to make the mortgage. The thought never crossed their mind that next year wouldn't be better. Next year wouldn't be better. I'm going to say by 1962, he had gotten like a couple promotions and there was a little bit of inflation, that the mortgage was half of one paycheck, and they never looked back. And I don't know that people's view of the world necessarily is now that they're going to be doing that much better every year going forward. I mean, why? I think that confidence has been shaken a little. I mean, you talk to people on the mortgages all the time. And what are they feeling? Are they feeling, okay, I can make this mortgage because we're making 100 grand this year, but next year, don't worry, we'll be making 110 the year after 120. What are these people thinking? You talk to more of them than I do.
To me, they're only focused on today. I can make, you know, I have, these are my monthly debts. I can pay them, and that's it. They're not focused on what will happen next year. It's just about today. That's about as far as it goes.
Go ahead, Jen.
They just don't go any further than that. How do I survive today? That's the idea.
Jen, sounds like you have a question.
About month.
Well, one thing that I, you know, can really feel and hear from a lot of people about is states that were destinations for retirees, you know, people who had reached a point where they, you know, could downsize, they could live well, maybe better than they had been living. And they went to Florida, they went to Texas, they went to California. Those, you know, housing prices there, I think, are poised for a huge downturn. I mean, it's happening already, I think, in certain places in all of those states.
I agree. I agree with that. I mean, in Florida was such a hot destination. And just last night, someone called me and said, I'm so glad that you talked to me about this buying in Florida. And, I mean, the guy called me on a Christmas Eve and had to have his pre-approval letter and call somebody else as I'm walking out the door. Like an idiot, I do it. And he said, you were really right. I mean, they thought that you could just live in Florida and work from Florida and no one was ever going to return to work. And now with all the disasters that have happened through no faults of the people that live there. I mean, the condominium building falling down, right? All the hurricanes, the devastation, the insurance companies want to pull out. Now everybody's saying, I don't know if I really want to go there, right? They don't know. And so this guy was like, I'm so glad I didn't buy it out there. And he invested elsewhere. And I just don't understand, you know, these prices are going to have to come down. The communities are going to have to come down. And these states are not necessarily disasters. It's just, it's like Florida's not a disaster. It's just right now it's going to be difficult to get financing in there. You know, when I was, got in my early 20s, a couple told me that, a retired couple, I mean, they were like in their 60s, that they sold their home and they bought a condominium. And the reason they did it is it cost $18,000, and they were living off the sale of their home. You know, that was their retirement package. And it worked, but now condominiums are as expensive as your houses.
Nance, what happens? I was at my bros yesterday for dinner, and he, well, my sister-in-law, cousin, who the hell knows, somebody is where the first hurricane hit. So we're not talking, that's 3 years ago, three and a half, somewhere. It's a while, right? It's not the one last year. It must be several. The one that hit Naples, where all the people in Chicago got whacked. I think it was 3 years ago. Well, she was as a condo on an eighth floor of a, I don't know how many, so I'm going to say 18 floor building or something. And of course, all the idiots left their cars in the parking lot. So when the water came in, it raised the cars up and was whacking them into like the fifth floor of the building. Well, it's, I'm going to say 2.5 years. She still can't get into her apartment to get her stuff. I mean, they were able to go up there once, I think. No determination at all on whether they're going to tear the building down or try and fix it, because structurally it's unsound. Now, are they still sending tax bills there, and does she have to keep paying her mortgage? What the insurance company is just dragging, and they evidently, since the, remember when the place fell on the other side of the of Florida? In the
yes, I know about that one. That was like in Fort Lauderdale, maybe?
Yeah, well, then they have all these code things. Now they've upped the code. All those engineering companies were already busy before there was a hurricane. Who knows when they're going to get to this place? Now, do you have to keep paying your mortgage? And do they have to keep paying the tax bill, even though nobody can live in the place?
Yeah, I don't think they get, you know, a break on that. It might be...
I don't either. I agree with John. I don't think so. I mean, you owe money, and the collateral is the collateral. So, you know, if you default, then you default, and maybe the bank has to take it back, but it wrecks your credit. You're never going to get anything out of it. And then how do you move on?
Right. But you've had to, unless you're sleeping on Audrey's sofa, I mean, you've had to pay rent somewhere else for 2.5. How do you do that?
I don't know. Yep. These are all problems that people are facing, and they're real problems, and they have to figure it out. Most likely, they've walked away. I mean, if you know, you can't squeeze blood out of a turnip. Everything they had of it, and so just imagine, if you had a lot of equity in there.
Yeah,
you're never going to see it.
Can't speak. Squeeze blood out of a turnip. What a very Irish saying, Nance, of the week before St. Patrick's Day.
Well, I don't know.
Yeah, very. That was. I like that one.
For staples, Tom.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a... What happens to the... I mean, I'm looking at the wealth numbers. If we have, and I, you know, my significant other, Odd, I mean, she disagreed with me in 2007, and she's still doing that, regarding... Whenever the housing prices get a lot higher than the average person can afford, I'm not saying bad things can happen, but you've got to be careful that they don't, because if they do, it can be ugly. I mean, what do you think a 15% drop in prices across the board does to everything, Nance? I mean, is it some people didn't matter, right? I mean, they bought the place lower, it's up some, and you know, so what? But
correct. But
you were mentioning last time you were on, and I talked to you in the meantime. You're starting to get some refis due to credit card bills. Those got to be a real tough deal for you, aren't they?
Well, it's just there comes a point when your credit score. In other words, if you have a credit card, let's say the limit is $10,000, you really shouldn't be over about $3,500. After that, it starts affecting your score. Okay, so when someone says to you, you know, we'll put this on free financing for a year. So let's say you're buying a couch and they do that for you. That's great. But because you bought the couch, let's say, for $5,000 and you have $5,000 limit, that affects your credit score. So if you start living on credit cards, which a lot of people have done, because no one is going to refinance their house when they have this exceptionally low rate, they use their credit cards. And it's just very hard to believe that people can run up credit cards to, you know, and have the balance at, you know, $20,000. And then you have someone who has five of those, well, then they have $100,000 on credit charges. And that's how they've been making up for being out of work, you know, all the things, the emergency money that is not there, they're using the credit cards and they're hoping they can pay it off when they get back to work and so on. But now we've had all this increase in pricing. So there comes a point where you almost have to give up the lower rate and get the noose off your neck, or you're going to lose it all.
So somebody
and
owes
come a point when you can pass over and you can't get it done at all.
So somebody owes $200,000 on his mortgage at 3%, but now owes $100,000 on his credit card at 30%. It's time to go for the 7% mortgage, is what you're saying.
Well, I'm saying that I actually have people who, let's say, have $125,000 on their mortgage and they have $150,000 in credit card debt. At that point, it's you got to go. You have a small window where you just got to take this and flip it around, because obviously when your credit card debt is at 23% interest, some are 29%. And let's say two of them are at 13, you've got actually more in credit card debt than you own your home.
I'm going to guess somebody with that kind of credit card balance has none at 13. But maybe. I guess it'd be
they could have one or two because they have these zero balance transfer things.
Okay.
I'm just saying, at some point you have to say to yourself, if they would call me, I can look at it and say you have this much time left or whatever, but sooner or later credit scores are going to start taking the dive and then you won't be able to refinance at all.
People are all different kinds of people, right, with different motivations. I hope I have enough faith in somebody to not have a $10,000 limit on their credit card and blow it all on furniture for the living room or a new boat. Of course, you're not getting much of a boat for $10,000. I read somewhere, John, you and I talked about it probably 2 years ago, that virtually all people that have to declare bankruptcy or something on their credit card, the initial stuff on there was either a medical expense they didn't expect, or a transmission, or something that came out of the blue and ended up on that credit card. Is that still the right number, or are these totally, I spent too much at the restaurant and on a sofa, that's why I'm up to $10,000? I mean, I can't imagine people do that much, Nance, do they?
I don't think that's it. I've talked to people about, because I always talk to them about the future after we're in the house, what are you expecting? And when I'm asking people what they're spending on groceries, honest to God, the average, just 2 to 4 people are spending somewhere between $250 to $500 a week on grocery. And by groceries, I mean that covers everything, your cleaning supplies, your toilet paper, your eggs, all of it. Not buying food out, just buying food to cook. And, all your household supplies.
Well, I think some of that is depending on what areas of the city. I told you, Nance, I took the bus from my mechanic last week, and I see people getting on the bus with 3 bags from it's Pete's, which is, a decent-sized
yes.
big store, going down Kedzie to 79th going east, just because they probably saved a few bucks at the Pete's from anything local, if there was a place local. I mean, some of the guys in the building that are engineers, will say, they paid 10 bucks for a dozen eggs in, their area. It turns out I'm grabbing eggs for the guy at Meijer's on Sunday morning at $8. I mean, they're not members of Costco, not members of Sam's. I mean, you can get absolutely hosed if you don't have your eyes open. But even then, it's expensive. I mean, it's not like you're going to cut it down to zero
right.
or something. But
right.
But yeah, the expenses right. are crazy.
I mean, even a full pie. I just happened to stop in and I had a taste for a pie in it. So just for the heck of it, I looked and. Just a cherry pie at the Jewel was a whole pie was like $15. This is nuts.
What about the little ones, Jen? The ones that came, they were like 25 cents. You got the little one, you got like 4 bites out of it. What are those things?
Yeah, Aldi's has them for $4.
Doesn't Hostess
a whole
still
pie?
Like
a
pie
or is
no,
just the Hostess pie.
Not the little Hostess pies, but then they had the ones that were they actually were in the aluminum. I look, the pecan pies were to die for. I don't know if they have those around anymore. They were like $1 though. The pecan pies. Like a gazillion calories. I used to get one. God, how stupid is this? I used to get off the L when I was remodeling that condo after I got laid off from Pullman. And I'd walk into this little Mexican grocery store, real tiny little place. I'd get one churro, those long pastry things, and a little pecan pie. It was like a buck and a half with a cup of coffee. I was good to go. You could have done that, Nance. You didn't eat some huge ass. So what'd you do? Buy a 12-inch pie and knock it down yourself?
No, I didn't buy anything.
Oh.
I just figured forget it and that's it. I mean, I can make my own. I can make my own pie. I mean, it's not the end of the world. But I'm just saying the shock of it for me was just like, oh my God.
Did you go to Orland Bakery? It might have been 25.
I did go to Orland, and you're right. I mean, there it's even more. 6 cupcakes at Orland Bakery. Yesterday was $9.50.
Wow. Well, the people at the Myers 2 weeks ago were absolutely outraged that the punchkies at the Orland Bakery were up to $3 a throw. $12 for a set of 4, John. It was a big topic of conversation at the Myers. Because the Orland Bakery's got great stuff, but they've kind of gone goofy on the prices. But anyway.
Well, Tom, when you were saying that people have their wealth in their houses, and, you know, Nancy, you're talking about, you know, what people have to do to pay for their groceries. They have to do the same kind of thing to hold on to their investment in their homes, too. I mean, I think a lot of people are putting things like home repairs, furnace replacements, you know, whatever, on, you know, the card. Because
they have to do the same thing. And the person who ran up the credit cards, it was not on luxury items. I mean, it was necessity for a lot of crazy stuff that went wrong. And, you know, one was fixing the car, you know, just living. Like you're saying, it was, there was household repairs, and it wasn't fancy. I mean, they bought the stuff at Home Depot, did it themselves. And it's an accumulation probably of 4 years, 5 years of stuff. And then one of them lost their jobs for a while, and then they took temp jobs, and that kind of thing. It's not when you think of that, you think, oh my God, what did they do? Go out and buy a car? At least when I said, what did you buy with this? They knew. It wasn't anything lavish. It was just necessity over about a 4-year period.
Well, we have the building I sort of manage because the owner's nowhere to be found. Needed a hot water heater a couple weeks ago, and I keep a little bit of the rent back in cash in case something like that happens. Well, the water heater's $3,200, and I got a guy, and so I had a little bit of reserve in the rent. Well, guess what? I'm the credit card. I had to write a check for $2,500. You know, I fortunately didn't have to put on a credit card, but I'm sitting there going, $3,200 for water? That wasn't in the budget. I mean, for God's sake. I would have guessed.
It wasn't in anybody's budget.
I would have guessed top of the line. If you'd asked me if you'd have put you know torches to me, I would have said $2,000 tops. Well, it turns out that the water heater was $2,300 for a nice one, and the guy wanted $900 to put it in, which took 3 guys half the day, so I can't really begrudge them that. I'm like, good Lord.
Yeah, and I moved in my house in 1987, and I bought a 30-gallon water heater was $125, and I think I bought a 40 for like $185 instead, because I kind of thought 30 was not enough. So my point is that, I mean, it was less than $200, and look at what we're saying now, 35 years later.
Yeah.
And the salaries are not going up compensating with that.
Not even close.
So people are having to, get loans, dip in their credit cards, and that's why these home equity lines of credits have been so big. But the problem with that is they're all up at 8% or 9% interest as well.
Well, it's so easy. I mean, I don't think Jen and I, as much as we bark back and forth with each other, when Audrey started mentioning, Audrey's been in real estate for a while, and of course she's still part of PTI, but she started talking about people only wanted move-in houses, move-in ready houses.
Right, move-in ready, yes, and that's still true.
Well, my first thought is a grumpy old guy who used, is fairly handy, or at least I used to be. My thought is that these young kids don't want to do anything, which absolutely was the wrong thought, even though it's the first one to popped into my head. At the end of the day, they don't have the money left even after you get them the best mortgage. They can't handle a $5,000 expense the next month. They want the
thing. No, they can't.
It's not about being lazy.
Right.
It's just about the way it is.
And they need the break of a year. It's like buying a car for, If you get the car for 60 grand or whatever you're paying for, at least you better get a 3-year warranty on the damn thing. So, but hopefully in 3 years you'll have a few shekels around or something breaks, you can actually fix it. The last thing you want in a new car is to have a repair bill, right?
Correct. What will I say? Anything you buy that you don't want it to break.
Well, when Audrey bought her car, and remember we went with, and was it you or Kat? Anyway, so, I think it might have been Kat. Might have been Kat. Was you?
And what,
well, when you guys were out driving the thing around at 100 miles an hour, like Audrey likes to do, just testing it, making sure it was okay, right? And I was talking to the guy in the dealership. When I heard they have a finance department for repairs now, I'm sitting there. This is not the world that I grew up in. I knew you had a finance department for a new car. I never dreamed you have a finance department for a repair.
Right?
That is scary.
My mouth was open.
Yeah.
That they actually, and the only reason we knew is because we were in the finance the car.
Yeah.
And then they started talking about, you know, this, and I was like, oh my God, you gotta be kidding me.
But you know,
it's just a shot. Not because it can't be done. I mean, actually, it's a decent idea, but it certainly was shocking.
Well, I'll tell you what, that dude got out a nice truck because she's not had one issue with that thing, knock on wood.
It was very lucky to run into that because you can buy a lemon and they worry yet.
Well, you know, John is one of those, if you know people, the guy knew Aud needed a car, so he called her up and said, this guy's been my client forever. I said, what, his wife leased it for 2 years and it was like 10,000 miles on it or something, and And they had done all the oil changes. I mean, they had a full history on it. And how often do you get something like that? I mean, kind of rare. Anyway, Nance, good stuff. Good seeing you yesterday. John, maybe we'll get to see you one of these days.
Got
to
get you out.
Yep. It's spring, you know.
We're not going to take you to an escape room and lock you in. It's going to be okay.
Well, you only got like a month, Nance, because it's going to go from being too cold to being too hot. He's only got a short spot where you can come out where it's not too cold or too hot. You only got a month.
It's coming up.
God. Yep. SP Futures down 76. Hey, we rallied back from being down 80. Only down 76. NASDAQ Futures down 322. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.